This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And what a week. We're facing the worst public health crisis for a generation as coronavirus is declared a pandemic. It triggered the biggest one-day fall in stock markets around the world since 1987. Interest rates were cut, and in amongst all that, we had a budget. Fags, potholes and pensions were, I can tell you, not top of the agenda, though they were in there. So what else was? We'll take a look. Also, what you can do to protect your pension and investments. Ask what businesses will be most affected by coronavirus and encourage you to get travel insurance now. Simon and Lee dissect the week that was and explain what it means for you and your money. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, it was meant to be all about the Boris bounce, life out of Europe, the levelling up of the economy, but instead, coronavirus and battling its effects took centre stage in Rishi Sunak's first budget. The new Chancellor promised a huge wave of support, particularly for small businesses. And while not many, there were still some other, perhaps more traditional budget measures in there, though not the hoped-for stamp duty cut, nor a feared raid on pension tax relief and a mansion tax. So what was in, what was not? But firstly, the morning of the budget, we saw a move from the Bank of England, cutting interest rates by 0.5%. Simon, Lee, welcome. What did you make of that move, Simon?
I think the Bank of England thought it had to be seen to be doing something. It had to be seen to be doing something big. And what the Bank of England was trying to do was show that it was getting ahead of the curve. Now, if we go back to the days of the financial crisis, the Bank of England was considered to be behind the curve. In fact, the word around the city in the summer of 2007 was Merv's behind the curve. So it's incorrect to suggest that basically people didn't see some of the financial crisis coming. By the summer of 2007, and that's before there were any queues outside any branches of Northern Rock, there was already talk about this thing called the credit crunch. I remember it because I was working. We were writing a few stories about it. Not lots. We weren't predicting what was going to happen, but it was on people's radar. And in the investment world, there were calls for a rate cut for the Bank of England to get ahead of the curve. Instead, the Bank of England actually raised rates just before the financial crisis, and Merv was behind the curve. So, Carney, fortunately, doesn't rhyme with curve.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But the Bank of England wanted to get ahead of it. So they cut rates by 0.5%. Big problem is, of course, interest rates are only at 0.75%, so you've not really got anywhere to go. The other two measures that they brought in, funding measures to try and push cheap money through banks to businesses in particular, and then on top of that, reducing banks' counter-cyclical buffers, which I saw the joke the other day of that's not an elderly member of the MPC,
right.
the buffer. That is something that controls how much lending banks can do. That's all designed to push money through to the real economy. And I think those two measures are probably the more important ones.
Mm-hmm.
The rate cut is symbolic. I think the problem with the rate cut is that I don't really think that it achieves anything. I think interest rates are so low. Mortgage rates are knocking around rock bottom levels. The problem that we have is not the price of borrowing money. Why do you cut interest rates? You lower the cost of borrowing money, so you hope that people borrow more money and then they go out and it feeds into the real economy. Now, the problem is not that money is too expensive. Money is cheap. The problem that banks and building societies have at the moment is that they are more keen to lend mortgages than people are to borrow them. That's why we're seeing a mortgage price war. Businesses are not complaining about the cost of borrowing money from banks at the moment, which is what changing the base rate influences. Businesses might be choosing not to borrow money from the banks. Businesses might be finding that the banks are saying to them, well, we won't lend to you because we think you're too risky.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're not having is the problem of that if they could get a loan, the price of that loan is just a little bit too high. On the flip side, this is going to hammer savers. It's going to encourage people to go hunting for yield in places that are more risky than they need to be hunting for yield just exacerbates the problem that we've had before. And so I don't really think it was probably the best thing that could have been done. Maybe we should have held it in reserve to a later date, but I can absolutely 100% understand why the Bank of England chose to do it on Wednesday morning, and it gave the impact that if they had just announced those other two parts of it, it would not have had. And then it tied in with the budget later in the day, which, as you say, this was going to be the Boris bounce budget. This was going to be the one where we were worried there were going to be so many spending measures in it, it might stoke inflation. The country's economy was about to take off. You know, were we going to see these tax cuts? Were we going to get a stamp duty cut? Were we going to soak the rich to pay for some of this? None of that. Out the window. That. Boris bounce, done for. We can forget about that one now. This was the coronavirus battling budget, and the cornerstone of that budget was about firefighting, not this kind of like, woohoo, off we go.
Yeah, absolutely. A very, very different tone for... you've got to feel a bit sorry for Rishi Sunak. He's only been in the job 6 weeks.
I don't feel sorry for Rishi Sunak because he smashed it on Wednesday.
Okay, I mean, yeah,
that
I was going to say beforehand.
Absolutely one of the best performances by a Chancellor that I've seen in a long time. I thought he looked absolutely natural standing up there and doing it. And even with the, you know, comedy pantomime of the get it done. I thought he did a really good job. He had some nice jokes in there. He didn't do a Philip Hammond and try and just crack a joke every 30 seconds. He saved them. And the little red book one for John McDonnell, even John McDonnell laughed at that one.
There you go then.
Yeah.
No rabbits out of the hat either. You know, I think he came across rather well. I think Twitter agreed with that. Before we move on to sort of the substance, it may be even a bit more style, if you'd like to talk a bit more about Rishi's performance there, Lee. But I think people were quite impressed with the Bank of England and the government coming together. The decision to cut interest rates on the same day of the budget, it was seeing that the two were working together hand in hand and going forward, that would be a good thing in tackling what, you know, Boris Johnson, these were not my words, I should have said at the start, the worst public health crisis for a generation, that was Boris Johnson's words, but being seen to be doing something together.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you, Georgian. I think actually it was definitely a surprise. I think it caught quite a few people by surprise, usually when there's going to be...
The amount, though, wasn't it? I think some people thought maybe 0.25%, but the full 0.5%?
Yeah, just went full whack for it. And there's nothing more exciting than a budget day for a financial journalist. And then as you sort of get up and you're coming in and then you realise that base rate has been cut as well, that's quite a double whammy. Then we've had stock market panic and, you know, markets crashing just to throw it into the mix. It's been a strange old couple of weeks. Yeah. There's been so much going on, and trying to keep a pace with it all has been, you know, quite difficult. But I thought Rishi Sunak did a very good job. You know, bearing in mind he's been in the job for a matter of weeks, to come in and give that kind of measured, assured performance when all of these different things are happening. Not to mention, you know, Brexit's just gone out the window.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've just completely forgotten about it almost. You know, we've had a backdrop of all of these things, and obviously the way in which he became Chancellor as well was all kind of mired in a bit of controversy. And, you know, I thought he stood up. I actually most of the time forgot that it was his first budget and he'd been Chancellor for hardly any time at all. So you can only say that that's a good thing, right?
So there's the style. What about the style, substance?
The substance.
Let's talk about the coronavirus, because we'll get on to the more sort of, like I said, the traditional budget measures as well. And also there was some spending, infrastructure spending. We got that promise, didn't we? So the levelling up, as Boris Johnson was talking about. Like you said, not much about really anything about Brexit, was there?
I don't think there was, no.
Coronavirus, a lot of emphasis on the smaller businesses.
Yes.
Because why, Lee?
Well, there's been a lot of talk over, you know, how small businesses are going to cope, essentially, if people are going to be off sick for a couple of weeks. The knock-on on supply chains, the knock-on effect on all kinds of businesses is likely to be huge. There's going to be a lot of people that, you know, perhaps don't have statutory sick pay, self-employed, you know, gig economy workers. There's all those kind of worries that if they were going to go off ill, how are they going to cope? That then has a knock-on effect to how they live their lives and how they can afford things like their mortgages and rent and food and all those kind of things. So they basically decided that there needed to be, you know, some confidence some confidence thrown at them from this coronavirus. I'm going to call this the coronavirus budget, because essentially it was a lot of measures about coronavirus with a little bit of personal finance bolted on. So, you know, basically gave a blank checkbook to the NHS to deal with this crisis. I mean, you know, that has been a political football. It's always been a political football, but the last, you know, few years, especially with the general elections that we've had, you know, he's stood up and said, there's going to be huge pressure on the NHS, which there's going to be. You know, we're fortunate in this country in that we have the NHS, but things like this could cause it to buckle. You know, I'm thinking about all of those hardworking frontline staff that are having to, you know, cope with people potentially coming in with coronavirus, which you'd like to think for the majority of people won't become a serious health issue, but for people with underlying health issues and, you know, older people, you know, to give them the care that they need, the NHS is probably going to need more money. Small businesses, some of them are going to see business rates scrapped for the next 12 months, depending on the size and depending on what they do. There's going to be loans available if you think
for the really smaller ones, isn't it? £3,000.
If you think you're going to be affected.
It's worth noting that those £3,000 sums are grants, actually. They're not loans. Mm-hmm. They're only for the small businesses. But, you know, they won't have to pay that money back. And what people need at a time like this is cash flow. It's cash flow. If you don't have cash flow, that's what sinks your business. But there's also business interruption loans of up to £1.2 million for larger businesses as well.
Yeah. So there is help for small businesses. And like I said, particularly with the business rates, those are focused on the retail, hospitality and the sectors that are going to be most affected. And we'll get onto those in a minute when we're talking about the stock market and particularly... Mm-hmm. travel as well. But what else was in there in terms of coronavirus? You talked about the self-employed. What about the sort of statutory sick pay?
So there'd be statutory sick pay of £94.25, even if you have no symptoms and you're told to self-isolate. So basically there's that kind of worry for people that sort of drag themselves in perhaps into work when they shouldn't, or might have come into contact with someone perhaps that's had the virus. You know, it's to try and limit the spread. But if people don't have that statutory sick pay, they might, you know, still coming to work anyway because they can't afford to lose that money. So they've kind of said, you know, you won't lose out if you need to isolate. And basically self-employed gig economy workers will get benefits fast-tracked. Again, hopefully they won't lose out. And actually, I thought something that's quite interesting is that sufferers can get sick notes via 111 rather than going to the GP. It's like a new sort of like helpline kind of way of dealing with this to stop people going into their local GP, perhaps having coronavirus, more people then catching it from going into the GP surgery. And it's measures to kind of stamp this out and get it into this kind of like containment phase that we keep hearing about and how to try and stop the spread going so quickly.
Yeah, but also we can't forget, I mean, you talk about absolutely you don't want people who are sick and infected going to GP surgeries, but there are also people, and we talked about, you know, the pressure that the NHS is under, you know, an ageing population, but people are genuinely sick for other reasons and will be needing to go. So the pressure is going to be immense. In terms of the NHS 111 service, I mean, the waits on the phone are about an hour, I think.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
If you do need this, and I just hope that the resources are still there for everybody. But this is... And of course, you know, money is no object when it comes to people's lives and the health and safety of the population. But in terms of how much money there is available for this, where are we financially speaking in terms of the UK economy to weather this storm? Because we got a 30 billion measure, 12 billion specifically for coronavirus. As Lee said, Simon, it's an open checkbook for the NHS. I imagine for policing as well, should that need to come in. Can we afford it? Not that there's an option, but...
Right, so can we afford it? No, not really. Mm-hmm. Probably going to have to borrow the money. But can we afford not to do it? No, we need to do it. We need to deliver this support because the cost of not delivering that support will be far greater than the cost of doing so. This is going to effectively pause the economy, I would suggest. There's been a lot of bad news filtering out. Mm-hmm. Unsurprisingly, share prices have been falling quite heavily, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a minute. Is all of that bad news priced in yet? Maybe for some companies it is, but maybe for others it isn't. I mean, it's fairly unprecedented to see some of the measures going on in other countries. And then if you think, well, if that happens in the UK, we get an Italian-style lockdown here, which I know the government said yesterday that they weren't going to push for yet and may not actually push for, as we appear to be adopting a slightly different tactic. But even the things that are being talked about are going to create a massive pause in the economy. Can it just bounce back from that? Do we have the resilience to do so? The important thing is to keep money going into people's pockets so they don't lose their jobs, lose their wages, to give businesses time, the time that they need to pay, to give them that cash flow that I talked about a minute ago. Mm-hmm. And if we can do all of that and the coronavirus infection sweeps through the country, and I'm not an epidemiologist, so I don't know how these things work, but sweeps through the country and then goes away, yeah, and is, you know, it's not, or is not as drastic as the situation we appear to be facing now, then maybe come the end of the year we can bounce back. What we're going into it with is flat GDP in the last quarter of last year. We are almost certainly, I would suggest, going to see a recession. Unless we basically wake up on Monday and coronavirus has suddenly gone away, I see no way that we're not going to see a recession. I think we're definitely going to see a recession, is what I should be saying there. I think I'm double negativing myself. So yeah, I mean, we've got to afford it. That's the answer. I mean, on the plus side, borrowing costs are really, really low at the moment because government bond yields have absolutely tanked. I mean, the 10-year is down below 0.3%.
I'm going to ask you more about those in a minute, but I want to bookend, as it were, the budget and sort of see what else was in there. Mm-hmm. We've got the coronavirus. In terms of, let's go for infrastructure spending, so levelling up the country, we had $2.5 billion, I think, over 5 years to potholes, you know, other road measures. I know,
there's always potholes.
Do we have much for housing? What do we have, Lee?
Well, there is going to be £600 billion spent on roads, rail, broadband and housing by mid-2025, which sounds like an absolutely huge sum, doesn't it, when you lay it out like that. £27 billion of that is going to be road building, including that two-mile tunnel near Stonehenge that always gets bounded around if that's ever going to happen. Yeah. And as you say, there's going to be £2.5 billion for potholes, but you know, it's just like, it feels like we're always throwing money at the pothole problem and nothing really seems to yeah, happen with it. Elsewhere in the budget, and things that we picked up on and things that I think are worth pointing out and worth noting, the pension taper. So talking about the NHS, and we were talking about this in the podcast recently, they've actually made changes to the taper. So doctors, essentially senior doctors, who earn up to 200 grand can work extra hours without being penalised for their pension. So there was this whole issue in which a lot of senior doctors that earn big sums of money were not taking on the extra hours that they could have taken on because they were worried about getting stung on their pension. So they've made changes to the taper. It means that from April, 98% of consultants and 96% of GPs will no longer be hit by tax bills. But he hasn't abolished this taper altogether. It means the taper has been raised, and it will be raised from people that are earning from 110 grand to £200,000, which sounds like huge sums of money. It sounds like a rich people's problem. But these are doctors that have worked long and hard in their careers. They are paid these sums because, you know, they've worked their way up the chain and they were being penalised by this. So the government has realised that this is an issue, especially given the light of coronavirus. I would suggest that, you know, more of these doctors might be encouraged to work longer hours,
yeah,
and do this.
Exactly.
And be something. Now, another thing that actually our pensions reporter, Tanya Jeffries, picked up on, which is a bit of an exclusive and wasn't really picked up elsewhere, is that there's been a rush of over 75s claiming pension credit to get free TV licences, right? Mm-hmm. So we've had this whole thing about a TV licence and how it's funded, etc., etc. Now, actually, this rush is going to cost the government expected £600 million a year. So this 300,000 people that have applied for the pension credit. Also, they get other benefits from signing up for pension credit. This includes help with council tax, and it could be things like free NHS dental treatment, cold weather payments, assistance with rent, etc., etc. The BBC estimated the annual cost of funding free TV licences for over 75s is £745 million. So essentially, it yeah, sounds like it's been completely wiped out
yeah,
by more awareness around pension credit and people signing up for it, which I think is a really, really interesting little tidbit of story that came out from that budget. ISAs, Georgie.
Yeah.
Talking about rabbits and hats and
we
how...
We didn't get a new one, they did.
No, how former chancellors of past loved an ISA, loved a cheeky
George
ISA,
Osborne,
bit
yeah.
of cheeky ISA news. There wasn't too much, but the junior ISA limit, which is far less substantial than the adult ISA limit, is going to be up to $9,000 from £4,368,000 a year. Junior ISA is essentially a savings vehicle for children that adults can put money in, and when they turn 16, they can access them, and when they're 18, they can withdraw the money, and then it converts into an adult ISA. Now, actually, interestingly, there was some research that went around also in the aftermath of this, that a typical person puts £1,000 a year into a junior ISA for their child. So a lot of people were arguing that this is a kind of tax break for the rich and middle classes that can afford to save that kind of money yeah. for their children, which I can totally see.
What else can you argue that it is, though?
Well, you can't, but it's just, you know, but it's always, you should always be encouraged
not saying
to,
that's a bad
to save
thing.
For your absolutely. To save for your child. But exactly,
if you,
yeah.
If you want to save your dad, absolutely. But you know, it does seem to me that this is not going to impact the majority.
And I totally agree with you. It's already, you know, I would suggest for the very vast majority of the population, almost impossible to max out their adult ISA limit each year anyway, and then to also max out your child's tax limit, you know, is quite unlikely. Booze, alcohol duties, all frozen.
Yep.
Only second time in 20 years. Fuel duty frozen again. There were rumours, we've seen the oil price absolutely plummet this month, really go down, and you know, hovering around $30-$35 a barrel. What that means is a knock-on effect to the forecourts. It means that the cost of filling up your car, price of unleaded and diesel is likely to come down in the coming month. So that rumor then puts in a little bit of like, well, you could nudge up fuel duty
this is
a little
what I
bit.
Mean. Why not hit the sort of the ones like the syntaxes and those sorts of things? And I'm not saying that fuel is syntax necessarily, but it has been held for 10 years and it would have been a time. I'm not saying this was a time to bury bad news, but it might have been because in the past you probably didn't want the white van headlines that, you know, we've had in the past, Simon. You look like you're almost going to hit me.
I mean,
there.
So
what was that look for?
Bear in mind that... you know, Boris is the new king of the north, right? There's been talk about how he needs to reward the people who voted for him.
You're saying everyone drinks loads up north?
No, the people in the... No, I'm talking about petrol.
Oh, right.
So if you don't live in London or commute into London, chances are you have to drive to work.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you know, unless you... Some people get the bus and stuff, but public transport outside of London is woeful. Even in most of Britain's major cities, public transport is woeful. Most people have to drive to work, they have to drive the kids, they have to do all the... You know, they have no choice but to drive. We have not put in place the infrastructure that means people can not drive. So hitting them with a fuel duty rise after you've just been crowned the king of the north isn't going to make you the most popular person.
I would suggest like you said, it's anywhere around. I've had the pleasure of living in places like Manchester and Newcastle and Sunderland, and the... public transport is decent in the big cities, but in terms of anywhere else...
I have got a friend who works in transport in Manchester, and I said this to him. I said, well, you know, the thing is, unless you live in London and some of the other major cities, maybe Manchester and stuff, public transport is terrible. And he went, no, I'll stop you there, Si. Public transport in Manchester is terrible.
Oh, okay.
He said, it is not...
It might be just because I was going from point A to point B,
yeah,
no
he's
problems.
Like, no. He said, London, public transport
London
is good.
Of its
everywhere else in the country... it's terrible. He said, there's bits where it's not as terrible as other places. So he said, you know, Manchester's not as awful as it could be, but he said it's not fit for purpose for a city where you want to get people out of their cars.
But then wouldn't it have been better, we're talking about public transport, to raise fuel duty potentially and then use some of that money, I don't know if we can, but on improving public transport in more remote areas? And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, saying Manchester and Newcastle are remote areas. They're not. But actually, I mean, I think across the board, in big cities and more remote areas, do we need to improve the systems, Lee?
Yeah, well, definitely we need to improve the systems. But already on the price of the fuel that you buy per litre, 57.95 pence is made up of fuel duty already. So it's almost like the argument of how much higher can that tax realistically go?
Oh, you can add the VAT to that as well.
And VAT.
So, you know, a lot of your litre of petrol is it. And what they need to do is to encourage people into electric cars, which we go on to in a minute. But buses. Now, as we know, Boris likes buses. He likes to spend his spare time relaxing, drawing pictures of them. And they have talked a lot about buses, actually. But what we need to do is we need to radically rethink how buses operate in this country. We don't just need large buses that run every couple of hours. So, again, this is the prime example, you know, once you go outside of London, bus travel, you don't want to be doing that much. You know, we need smaller buses. We need to identify the pinch points. We need these kind of hopper buses that you get. We need buses that take commuters to the station in the morning and back in the evening, rather than and relying on them having to drive to the station and things like that. That's how we get people out the cars, not sticking an extra little bit on fuel duty. That doesn't really discourage anyone from driving. It just makes it a bit more expensive and makes people angry. Have we talked electric car grant yet? That is remaining. Okay, this is a big thing. We thought it might be removed altogether. However, the government sneakily hid the fact that it was being reduced from 3,500 to 3,000, and you're also not going to get it on 50 grand plus cars. Why won't you get it on 50 grand plus cars? Well, because 50 grand plus electric cars are good, yep. But 50 grand plus electric cars are bad because they're bought by rich people, and rich people are bad. So you don't get it on those. Problem is, electric cars are expensive, and there's quite a few of them that go above that 50 grand level. I-Paces, Tesla Model Xs, Tesla Model Ss. And yeah, the 3.5 grand grant does help encourage people to buy them. Do those people buying those really expensive cars need the extra grant? Should we be subsidising them? No. But what if they're going to go buy a Range Rover Sport instead and this tips the balance? Maybe we should still be giving them the 3.5 grand. They're not going to get it anymore. Big game changer coming in, though, is this benefit in kind taxation. We talked about it a few weeks ago. It's going to enable people to salary sacrifice electric cars through work. If that picks up, that could seriously drive demand for it as well. And car tax as well, that could be changing. There was a document hidden in the budget, call for evidence. They've decided that the mad car tax system that was introduced a couple of years ago, which was a flat rate for everyone and means that you could be driving around in a 5-litre V8 Mustang, which, hey, we like 5-litre V8 Mustangs, but maybe they should be taxed a bit more heavily than your little shopping car. That this wasn't a good idea. They want to reverse it. One of the suggestions in there is that you could pay the first year rate of tax every single year. You could be paying £2,000 a year to tax your car. That's an awful lot of money on the most polluting cars. And it even raised the prospect of applying it retrospectively, which, just to be clear, I do not think will ever happen. But that's a game changer. That's going to make a bigger difference to people than sticking the extra little bit of money on fuel duty.
Just listening to Simon there, Lee, talking about essentially green issues. I mean, we got a few plastic tax numbers thrown in there, but there are a whole load of issues, and I'm not saying coronavirus shouldn't have taken centre stage, it absolutely should have done, but there are a lot of issues that are going to still be in Rishi Sunak's in tray to deal with at some point, aren't there?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, housing is first time buyers is another one that people were getting quite heads up about.
And let's not forget about all the storm damage that caused the flooding. You know, there was another £500 million found for the flood defences. But, you know, how much more? Are flood defences improving? I mean, the thing is, we are an island nation. You know, it's quite difficult to, you know, keep all of these storms at bay and all these riverbanks from bursting. And you talk about new homes there. We have to be very careful, I believe, where new homes go. You know, there's no good building new homes on floodplains or places that are close to rivers, which, you know, you snigger and laugh, but, you know, it feels to me like there's a lot of property popping up, perhaps where they shouldn't be popping up. And that could just make these flood defences just absolutely, you know, ridiculous. But you talked about environment there. There's going to be a new tax on firms making plastic that doesn't contain 30% recycled material. There's going to be 30,000 hectares of trees planted, allegedly. There was a climate levy, actually, on businesses' gas use that was in there. So basically, that's going to raise a bit of money. So the tax that businesses pay on their gas use is going to go up fairly substantially. And going back to what we're talking about, fuel duty there, I think part of fuel duty freeze is going to be kind of sort of complemented by the fact that they are abolishing tax relief on red diesel. So this is used by construction firms. It's like a cheaper form of diesel that businesses can use. Farmers have been spared from this because they obviously use quite a lot of this red diesel, but that tax relief is going to be cut, and actually that pays for quite a bit of the fuel duty freeze. When I was looking through the document, when I was going through it with a fine tooth comb, looking at all those figures and graphs and charts and numbers, when my brain was frazzled on Wednesday afternoon. But, you know, there was a lot of comment in my inbox from climate campaigners saying that the budget didn't go nearly far enough for what they wanted. But, you know, it's kind of difficult with the whole coronavirus thing. And face it, it's like most of us are going to be grounded when it comes to things like airplane travel.
Well, yeah, there is that, isn't there?
You know, people can't really fly. Actually, air passenger duties going up a little bit, a couple of quid for long haul flights. But you know, we're not going to really be able to fly for the next couple of months. So you know, not saying that that's it's going to be probably a short term thing. But you know, we had a lot of comments come through. I would say the most I've ever seen from climate campaigners saying that the budget didn't have enough green credentials in it. But at the same time, fighting coronavirus, it's been a very unusual backdrop. I would say with Rishi Sunak, it's been such an unusual backdrop to come into. We've had coronavirus, stock market crashes, base rate cut. He's been in the job for a month. Strange ways that he's come in to become Chancellor. Brexit, Boris bounced, new Prime Minister. I mean, it's just a real... Honestly, he felt like in the eye of a storm. It was like that kind of calm. And I felt like all this other stuff's going on. And it actually, I found it quite reassuring. Yeah.
I do. Good to know, because one person that's probably not reassuring is President Trump, who decided rather on his own measure to ban flights from 26 European countries to the USA. Apparently that sort of shocked people in the White House as well, let alone the rest of the world and the global stock market. But I mean, we experienced the FTSE 100 falling almost 11% on the second worst day of trading ever, wiping up $160 billion. And that was on the Thursday, I believe it was. But whenever you guys have spoken in the past about the financial crisis and, you know, when we saw, obviously, stock markets tumble and everything go to pot, let's put it that way, you say it was like one of the most bizarre days. You kind of just walked around like zombie-esque, watching another one fall, and thinking, God, what's going to happen next? Did you get that impression now with what's going on in the stock markets and coronavirus in terms of the effects of finances, or is this completely different? I only say that because I saw someone who used to be of the parish of This Is Money say that they've not experienced anything like this since 2008.
No, we haven't experienced anything like this since 2008 in terms of the market crashing. And the market is definitely crashing. I think we can officially say that now. We have gone from being officially in a correction to officially in a bear market, which is when the market has fallen 20% from its peak. And in fact, the FTSE at the close yesterday had fallen 32% from its mid-January peak, which is a big number. Also triggers an interesting dilemma for yours truly, who always said that if the stock market falls 30%, he's buying. Too early to buy? I mean, I must admit, I think the news is going to get worse before it gets better. What you're looking for is the moment of... You can't tell when the market's going to turn, but what you're looking for is when everything just looks as bad as it could possibly look, the moment of the greatest pessimism. Are we there yet? I'm not so sure. I mean, the travel ban was certainly a step in that direction, coming on top of the sort of failure of central bank measures to lift markets. You had Ireland closing schools, nurseries, colleges. You've got Italy on complete lockdown. Mm-hmm. You had it being declared a pandemic. But, you know, I think maybe the point of peak pessimism is when we start to see Italy-style lockdowns in the UK, France, Germany, America even. You know, that's going to be a point of major pessimism.
If we do, Simon, if we do.
Yeah, but...
We may not.
No, absolutely. But that's the kind of things that you need to think about. We talked earlier about share prices falling, companies saying this is going to be very bad for them. We had Cineworld yesterday saying it may not be able to pay its debts. Mm-hmm. The firm behind TravelX has lost nearly all of its value. Obviously, travel money is not a great industry to be in at the moment. Yeah. Lots and lots and lots of bad news, but is all of it being priced in? Maybe not. We you know, this pause. What's different to the financial crisis is we were looking at banks and the prospect of those banks going bust. You know, when we talk about it, it's not necessarily the share price falls. Obviously, they were big. It's that, wow, could Barclays go bust today? Could Lloyds go bust today? Is Halifax going to go bust today? To think of those big high street banking names, the places where people have all of their money, and the prospect of them going bust was an existential crisis. Now we're looking at something different. The banks are in a much healthier position than they were back then. So fortunately, we're not looking at that. But we're looking at, will I be able to go out tomorrow? Will I have to stay in my house for a week or two? I mean, none of us have really experienced that, have we?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess...
Will businesses have to lay off staff? Will I be
able
to...
and this is, again, the same kind of existential crisis. The difference between this and the financial crisis is the financial crisis kind of unfolded quite slowly, in a sense. It seemed hard and fast, various things at the time, but it took a while to happen and unfold. There were talk. There was this talk about the credit crunch. There was all these other things, and you know, and slowly unfolded. Have we done enough to save this? Have we done enough? Coronavirus has been pretty swift, hasn't it? Mm. You know, we look back to the middle of January. Stock markets were riding high.
Could that be the reason, perhaps, for the? Because it's happened so quickly,
yeah,
that people
boom. Yeah, exactly. And so you've got these hard and fast falls. Thursday, 10.87%, second biggest fall on record. Bigger than Black Monday, in fact. Black Monday was 10.84%, but smaller than the day after Black Monday. We always talk about Black Monday, don't we? But we don't talk about the Tuesday after, when the stock market fell 12.2%. It's bounced a bit this morning as we're recording this podcast. Who knows what's going to happen in the rest of the day? I spoke last week about how there'd been a bit of a bounce. Was that a pause for breath and time to shuffle the deck chairs? Use the opportunity to do that. Yours truly didn't do that. My ISA doesn't look too friendly at the moment. No. I'm trying to avoid looking at it. Ironically, my one concession to a defensive investment in there is also down. But the question's going to be, when do things start to look better? Mm. When is the opportunity to buy in? When is the opportunity to be that contrarian investor who goes, everybody thinks this is awful, I think maybe it's going to start to get better? That's your own personal choice as to whether you do that. And you need to think about the risk that you're taking and whether you can afford to take it. I've got, you know, a comment here from a guy, Mark Dowding, Chief Investment Officer at Blue Bay Asset Management. He's saying that looking ahead, it seems that more severe things will come in the short term, and therefore the more extreme will be the fiscal and monetary policy response. That it's very probable the news flow around the virus will get worse. Infection rates, you know, are likely to accelerate in Europe and the US. You're going to get social distancing and all those things. But that, you know, we in the next couple of weeks, we may see the bottom of this current sell-off. If this is just a temporary pause, if in 6 months' time we've got to grips with this, then you could see quite a sharp bounce back, because everybody will suddenly just start going out and doing things as normal as possible. Markets always overreact. A very good comment yesterday from Darius McDermott at Chelsea Financial Services, that people with properly diversified portfolios won't have seen falls that are of the same magnitude as the stock market in general. In fact, actually, we're suffering really badly in the UK. The UK is the stock market that is around the world has fallen harder than most. So the thing that we look at, the FTSE 100.
Why has it?
I don't know. Who knows?
A lot of big oil companies in there.
A lot of big
there?
Oil companies. Mm. Yeah, so the FTSE 100 is a bad index, right? It's not a very good measure of the UK PLC. A lot of big international companies, a lot of oil, a lot of energy. That's obviously been hit very hard. Also, I wrote my column this week about why we shouldn't even really talk about the FTSE 100. We should talk about, if we're going to talk about the FTSE 100, we should talk about the FTSE 100 Total Return Index, because the stock market is down more than 20% on where it was 20 years ago. So when you're told to invest long term, then you should always say to someone, well, stock market's down more than 20% on 20 years ago, so why are you telling me this? Only if you look at just the price. If you look at the total return, including the dividends, the stock market is comfortably up. It's up by about 75%. That's roughly in line with inflation. Sounds okay until you work out that that's only 2.7% a year on average, which is pretty rubbish for investing over 20 years. But it has managed to pretty much keep pace with inflation, and you would have definitely struggled to do that with a savings account. But if you are only investing in the FTSE 100 and have only been investing in the FTSE 100 over the last 20 years, you are doing investing wrong. You need to be investing. You start with the global stock market, and then if you want to add an extra little bit of FTSE 100 exposure, you do that. You don't start from just investing in the FTSE 100. And if you had invested in the global stock market, you would be comfortably ahead of inflation over that period.
Lee, I want to ask you about, and bring back closer to home, a sort of what Simon's talking about is people that, you know your stuff, Simon. I mean, what about people who've just got, you know, let's say a basic stocks and shares ISA or something like that, and you know, they're perhaps new to investing and thinking, oh my God, I mean, our advice normally in finances is never bury your head in the sand, but is there sort of a bit of a la, 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 I'm just going to not look at my investments at the moment?
You have literally just described me, Georgie. Yeah, as someone who is a relatively novice investor, only really been involved for the last couple of years. And when I say I'm involved, I mean, I have a stocks and shares ISA that I have researched thoroughly what I wanted. I have not looked at it. I can't bring myself to look at it. And the same goes for my pension. Now, what I say with my pension is that I have diversified my pension. I was kind of, a lot of people were just stuck in their default pension fund. And I had a look and I kind of diversified it a bit. Again, though, you know, I can't bring myself to look at it.
Yeah,
you know,
the pension, I don't want to.
But I'm maxing out the contributions. So that's been ticking up nicely. And I can't bring myself to look at it at the moment. I think I'm going to wait for the dust to settle and wait to see what, you know, what happens. But this is why when you see those big, when you see those advertisements, you know, on tubes, on public transport, or wherever you see your advertisements for, you know, investing in things like stocks and shares, I said, it does say capital at risk.
Yeah.
And it does tell you that the stock market can rise and it can also fall. And I think if you, I think the worry is that some people have moved into those stocks and shares ISAs and not looked at it in a long-term game. So I'm thinking here something like an obvious investor who might have a lifetime ISA, for example, might be maxing out the lifetime ISA to then put towards a home deposit and have it in a stocks and shares ISA. And if they were about to buy a home,
yeah,
might have just seen a quite sizable.
And it's not like they can wait for 10, 20 years.
Exactly.
But they've used it for that.
But that begs the question, is it a suitable product?
Well, we could go down that rabbit hole.
And you can go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, as Simon always says, you know, 5-10 years, you should be looking at minimum investment outlook. I mean, this is the complete and utter reason why. Because, you know, there are dips like this. We've had, 10 years of kind of steady gains,
yeah,
and then something like a coronavirus that's kind of come out of nowhere quite quickly, and it's just completely ravaged markets. Had the Saudi Arabia-Russia oil wars that Saudi Arabia's decided to quickly throw into the mix, which has completely pummeled oil firms in the FTSE 100. You know, I personally, you know, as a novice investor, I'm just choosing to keep calm, carry on. I'm still drip feeding, you know, a monthly payment out of my bank account into my stocks and shares ISA. I don't know when I'm going to be brave enough to have a look and see what's going on.
Me too. I have been brave enough. And a couple of weeks ago, and this is why I was quoting Simon yesterday in the pub, actually.
The best place to quote Simon.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the pub. Because I was looking, I don't have a lot in a stocks and shares ISA. It was certainly less than it was, but it was just over a grand. About 2 weeks ago, it was down about, I think, about £70. And then last week, it was £24 it was down. And that was exactly the point in which Simon said, if you can't handle the heat of the kitchen, you got to get out, whatever the expression is. I didn't. It's now down £180.
Just to
180. Just to give you a kind of visual representation of how much this is affecting. And I've only got 1,250 quid in a stocks and shares ISA there. But you know, some people have lost a significant amount.
Yeah, so if you ramp that up, you know, if you ramp that to someone with a typical, you know, 10 grand, 20 grand, 50 grand,
yeah,
you can kind of imagine what kind of losses people are nursing, you know.
Exactly. We're hearing a lot from the Bank of England, from the government, that this is expected to only be temporary. However, did we not assume that when, for example, interest rates were cut, you know, 12 years ago, and we've had this kind of very long time of which the financial situation has not improved as we would like? So while coronavirus may, and we pray, only last sort of weeks, most months, hopefully not any longer, do you think that these measures that we're seeing, the financial implications, will last a lot longer? Or are you believing what they're saying that actually this is just going to be a temporary little blip that we're having?
I think it's being still slightly underestimated what the effect of pushing the big pause button will have on a very, very interconnected world. I think what is important, maybe if you're looking for the sort of sign of how could things be bouncing back, is to look at China. What's going on in China? Is production being stepped up off? Because they did press the pause button. And are they going back to work? Are they stepping up production? Things like that. I think you need to think about the impact that people not buying things, not going out, not travelling, not doing stuff will have upon various companies and various sectors. Maybe think about the ones that won't necessarily be affected by that, and then think about if that is the case, that this is this short, sharp stop, and then we can start to return to some semblance of normal, and that depends upon what happens with a virus, which is something that's almost impossible for any of us to predict. What bounces back and what will people flock to? Will they still flock to those companies that they see to be changing the world, doing something different, disrupting the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Teslas of this world? Will they rush towards that perceived growth that they can deliver? Will they rush towards the things that suddenly bounce back, that did so terribly, terribly, terribly badly and suddenly bounce back? And then overall, over the long term, still think about overlaying those big themes that you think how the world is changing. It's almost impossible to predict what is going to happen, but you have to try and work out at what point do you think that life is going to get back to life as normal, and then what effect will it have on everything. But I do think that maybe some of the impact is being undercooked, but in other places it's being overcooked.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, if you look at some of the things that have been hit absolutely the hardest by this, maybe the share prices have fallen too far. I don't know. What's going to happen to BA? IAG, the owner of BA. How are they going to deal with this? I mean, are we underestimating the impact on them so far? Or are we actually overestimating it? And in a year's time, it will be business as usual.
Absolutely. But there will be, doubtless, companies that falter, not just the small ones that our Chancellor is trying to protect at the moment, but big companies. Companies that, I mean, I'm thinking at the moment of Into, the shopping centre, who've announced that they're in a bit of trouble, but they were already in trouble. So it's the ones that...
This exacerbates the trouble,
precisely,
doesn't it? Footfall goes down in somewhere like, you know, Lakeside, which Into owns, and then it just has a complete knock-on effect to the companies that are, you know, the businesses that are in Lakeside or shopping centres that are owned by them, you know.
So it will exacerbate existing problems, but then in terms of, say, travel companies, you know, okay, it's a difficult industry, but who can account for the fact that this would happen? I mean, the best will in the world is people saying, oh, well, it's bad business if you can't account for disruption of this nature. But this, we've never seen anything like this, have we, particularly in the travel industry?
Okay, well, two sort of like little quotes from people. One, this is a black swan event. Remember those?
Yes, of course.
Ones that you cannot possibly predict that come out of nowhere. Who thunk this was going to happen, hey? And number two, Warren Buffett saying, when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked, basically.
Yes, that touché.
You know, when something bad happens like this, it exposes the businesses that already have problems.
Touché.
Maybe the travel industry will bounce back to this and everything will go back to life as normal. Maybe this will accelerate the structural changes within the travel industry, and actually we just won't be flying as much in the future as we are now.
I was speaking to a travel expert this week, actually, who said when 9/11 happened in 2001, he couldn't see the travel industry recovering from that, and the way in which we holidayed and travelled would have a knock-on effect and not confidence for a very long time. And he said simply it just didn't happen in the end. You know, those fears after those first few months of such a tragic event didn't have the knock-on effect that he and others in the industry thought it would.
Imagine we're travelling more now than we probably ever have.
You know, and that's the thing, you know, but this is going to knock confidence hugely onto travellers and holidaymakers. Look, we live in a country in which we're used to a diet of cheap flights, cheap holidays. We are lucky enough to be able to get anywhere, really, on the globe. You know, we've got all of these airport hubs. We can fly to thousands of destinations in Europe within a 2 or 3 hour time frame. What I think this is going to have a certain short-term impact, perhaps in the next 6 to 12 months, and this is just a personal hunch, is that people are going to leave booking holidays to the very last minute because they're worried about events like this. If you've booked something for April, May, June,
aren't you, Lee?
I'm affected. I was meant to be going to Italy on Wednesday. I was meant to be going to Florence this Wednesday coming. Ryanair finally cancelled the flight, and actually it was very painless to get the money back, which I was a little bit surprised on, but they did it. Airbnb actually is where we booked 6 of our 7 nights accommodation, and the reason why I mention Airbnb is that I've seen reports that they're massively down. And a lot of people worldwide have gone full-time Airbnb owners, as in they have properties that they rent out, you know, 90% occupancy rates. Well, that's going to crash, you know, and that has a knock-on effect. Now, the owner of the Airbnb in Florence where we were staying actually emailed us and said, she was so lovely about it. She was like, I know you have a young child. Personally, I wouldn't come. This was before advice not to travel to Italy. This was, you know, at the weekend. This is before with the FCO advice. And she said, you know, I would cancel it if I were you. You know, money back, obviously, not a problem at all. Love to host you sometime in the future.
We're hearing a lot of that, aren't we? Because we're going to talk about travel insurance. Mm. And talk about confidence in terms of travelling. But the first port of call, I guess, is if you are sort of going away, to ask the people like the Airbnbs, the hotels.
Exactly.
They're probably going to be a lot more accommodating because they want you back.
Exactly. We've got one hotel, actually, through booking.com that I'm currently struggling to still get the money back from. But, you know, look, you can write that kind of small amount off. We have travel insurance. We have travel insurance with a bank account. It would have covered us. The thing is, the excess would have made it pretty much not worth us covering this. This wasn't a £1,000-plus trip. You know, this was some cheap flights with Ryanair. It was a relatively inexpensive Airbnb for 6 nights and a hotel somewhere. Our travel insurance, for the Airbnb element, it definitely would have done. But look, we had free cancellation on it until a certain date. And that's actually a saving grace for a lot of this. A lot of these booking websites do have free cancellation policies. A lot of hotels directly will have free cancellation policies. Travel insurance, though, this is a broad stroke here, Georgie, but it's under pressure. The travel insurance industry, I would argue, is already under quite immense pressure for this. We're seeing policy sales rise, which actually I found very interesting, because you should be, if you're booking a holiday, regardless, you should be getting your travel insurance as you book. You know, you shouldn't be leaving it later down the line. People kick the can down the road because it seems like such a boring, onerous thing to do, but you need to get it done when you book your holiday.
There is not a lot, really, to look at coronavirus and say that there might be a small positive somewhere to be had. But I thought, you know, writing some travel insurance stories that have been, you know, in the last couple of weeks, I thought, this is great news. People are now taking travel insurance really seriously. We've got situations where, you know, 1 in 5 people don't bother travelling at all and with it, and of those that do, most of the policies just aren't suitable for them or won't cover them. So, you know, the fact that we've got one comparison website saying that the inquiries into getting travel insurance as to whether they actually buy it are up 170% in the last week. However, what's really disappointed me, though, but you can probably understand the reasoning why, is LV have been the first to say that they are going to stop selling travel insurance altogether. They, as part of their business as an insurer, travel insurance is quite a small part of it. And they're saying, look, rather than just hike everything up, we're just going to stop selling it altogether. But we are seeing other companies as well that are saying, you know, we're going to get any claim for coronavirus will not be covered for new policies. So even if you get the added on extras, which I had on my policy, it won't cover you. And that, to me, is just, for those people that think that travel insurance just isn't worth it anyway, won't pay out, I'm thinking the same thing now.
If you're shopping for your travel insurance now, if you're looking, you should always do this anyway. You should be looking at the small print. You should be seeing what's covered. Most definitely the two things that you should be looking at the moment is cancellation and containment cover. You know, you need to make sure that this is going to pay out if the FCO say you can't travel to this country.
But every day we're getting more and more coming out saying that
more and more.
You're not going to be covered in this case, which is the biggest issue at the moment.
And
causing,
it's basically, I think, to stop some of these insurers, you know, getting themselves into quite a bit of financial pickle, because, you know, if everyone's getting these insurance policies and they have to pay out, if coronavirus keeps going for a few more months, knocking on travel industry, you know, the knock-on impact. You know, it's.
I can understand why they've done it. Absolutely, but to me,
both sides. You know, and also, let's not forget, we've also seen Flybe collapse.
Norwegian have just suspended half of its staff because of coronavirus.
Tight margins. Something like Norwegian Air. You know, the flight prices to America are, you know, rock bottom. They are cheap. You can fly to America for a couple hundred quid. You know, and that must mean the margins are tight. And if they're turning around and saying we have to get rid of half the staff because of the impact this is having. You know, it kind of shows you
that we're not flying to America now, are they, presumably? Except from here.
And the travel industry, it could be fragile. It's fragile. An airline actually has a lot of sort of unknowns. You know, fuel prices, for example. Well, we've seen the oil price come down and fuel prices come down, so that's at least a little bit of respite for airlines. But there's all sorts of other bits and pieces that can happen that rocks confidence, knocks, you know, what the confidence of consumers, you know. So I can understand why travel insurers might be doing this. If we start to see, if we see all travel insurers do it, well,
so this is surely just the beginning, though, Lee. I mean, if the advice from everybody is saying, right, well, get travel insurance, get it now, and make sure you get it with this kind of cover. But there's fewer and fewer of them.
Travel bookings per se, as in people booking holidays, is going to completely drop off a cliff. So actually, you'd think it would balance out a bit. This is more, I would suggest, people panic buying their travel insurance that have perhaps, you know, let's face it, January flight sales, holiday sales are massive. It's a massive industry, you know, searches and, you know, booking of holidays in the new year after Christmas when all these things come on goes through the roof. And the amount of people that probably didn't get their travel insurance when they booked that, I'm going to suggest, is fairly high. You know, some people have annual policies, some people have policies that are through their bank accounts, but I think this is panic buying travel insurance, making sure they've got some sort of cover or policy in place for peace of mind, and because they realise that they've been caught short. So I think this is where we've seen a massive surge. I think actually the European Health Insurance got a little bit to blame, this EHIC. I think a lot of people just go, oh, what do I need travel insurance for? I'm covered for medical costs abroad, which you will be until the end of this year when it probably changes from next year. And I think they go, well, you know, a bit of luggage. The way we fly and go on holidays has changed a lot. You know, people have city breaks, for example, you know, they don't really think travel insurance is needed because perhaps they just think, well, it's not going to get cancelled and, you know, my luggage isn't really worth that much and I'm covered for medical costs, so let's just leave travel insurance. It's a mistake. You know, you should book it ASAP as soon as you buy, as soon as you get your travel insurance.
Absolutely.
Get your holiday booked.
Of course you should. Simon?
I would just strongly advise anybody who has a holiday booked in the future and does not have travel insurance at the moment to go out and buy some travel insurance now. And you need to check it. You need to check the cancellation and curtailment. And you need to check that it says that if the FCO advises against all but essential travel to a region, that it will pay out.
If it doesn't mention that,
you need to look at the bit where it says the exclusions and to see whether it excludes that. And if it doesn't mention it at all, don't just think it will pay out. It actually probably won't pay out. It might say it might do because of quarantine, but the FCO saying don't travel there doesn't count. It's the same as quarantine. And if you're in any doubt, as you said, phone them up and check. But if you have a holiday booked and you do not have travel insurance, get some now. Yeah. Because you are only going to see more travel insurers refuse to cover people. And there are still, there may be some who are saying no to new policies at the moment, but there are still lots that aren't.
Yeah.
So just do it now, or you may risk losing the cost of your holiday.
Lee, you mentioned there about the fact that hotels are being quite accommodating. We also got the news from EasyJet today that announcing that they, if you want to change your flight, they will waive any change fees. Although if there's a difference in the cost in the flight, you will have to cover that as well. I assume we're going to see more companies offering
I think we're going to see a lot more sort of flexible flight options out there. And I think actually holiday makers and actually in general, people just remember how they're treated by certain firms. You know, you know how they deal with this crisis will, I would suggest, live long in the memory of people. And if you are a company that treats your, you know, customers fairly, then, you know, you're probably going to come out as a winner, I would suggest. But this is uncharted times. I don't know.
Isn't it just? Because it's not just travel insurance as well. Insurance generally, I do want to ask you before I let you go. We got the announcement early on Friday morning that all elite football in England has been suspended. So no Premier League, no EFL fixtures, matches, FA Women's Super League, Women's Championship. They've all been postponed. I was meant to be going to Fulham against Brentford. They assume it would resume on the 4th of April, subject to medical advice and conditions. But what this brings up is, I mean, one, there's a delay factor. I mean, it was only Fulham Brentford, so I imagine people aren't travelling and have got hotel rooms and all those sorts of things. But, you know, that's where the travel insurance and the sundries come in. But also in terms of tickets and refunds, what are your rights here?
If an event is cancelled, you are probably going to get your money back. If you know, this is a very broad stroke, but you're right, there's a knock-on effect that if you've booked a ticket to an event, let's say in Edinburgh, and you're flying from London, you've got the flight, you've got the hotels, you've got all of those extra costs that a lot of people, again, won't have insurance that covers them for UK events because they simply just wouldn't have ever thought about it in the past. But, you know, the likelihood is a lot of these events getting cancelled. I saw that the Country to Country Festival, which is a country music festival that my wife was really excited about getting tickets for, but she didn't actually book. She left it to the very last minute just because she wasn't sure if she wanted to go or not. And that's been cancelled. And I saw people tweeting that they've got hotel booked. Rooms booked and all that kind of thing. It's going to be a massive knock-on effect. Talking about sports, there was a local journalist for my team, Southend United, saying it could cost the club up to £1 million in lost revenue if all games were behind closed doors for the rest of the season. That could sink the football club. It's already facing court battles, etc. You know, there's other smaller teams. I would suggest that this kind of knock-on effect from match day revenues and things could sink them. It could be the final nail in the coffin of what is something about the travel industry being fragile. Well, the football, lower league football industry is definitely a fragile industry.
A lot of people saying that it's all about greedy clubs, Lee, and I don't really think it's all about greedy clubs. Obviously, you know, people's health takes precedent. But there is also, and we shouldn't forget, there are people that are employed at these clubs, staff perhaps on, you know, who just come in and work on catering for one day of the week. You know, the local economies that will be impacted by not hosting these events. There is financial knock-ons and implications that could have quite serious consequences for individuals' lives.
Yeah, and you see that whenever you find a football club or a sporting team goes bust, don't you? You see the talk about how it impacts all of those people that work there. And to draw a broader comparison, while you're still able to go out and spend some money, if you do decide to still go out and spend some money and you're not practicing extreme social distancing, you've got a choice about where you spend that money. Now, all businesses need our money at the moment, and I'm sure the big supermarkets, you know, will struggle in the wake of this as well. Or I'm not sure how much their sales will have been completely bolstered by panic buying toilet rolls, whether that's a big ticket enough item to make a huge difference to Tesco's bottom line. But you have a choice where you spend every pound you spend. Mm-hmm. And if you do go to a restaurant, or you do go out for a drink, or you do go to a shop, or you do decide to go and stock up on books ready to self-isolate for 2 weeks, go spend that money in an independent shop. Go spend that money in an independent restaurant. Go spend that money, you know, at your local pub or something, instead of just spending your money with a big chain or chucking it to Amazon or chucking it to Tesco. Those are the people who are going to really, really need support through the months to come. And lend them a hand while you can, because if you'll be sad when they're not there the next time you walk down the high street or the next time you go out, give them some money now.
All right, well, that ended up being rather gloomy and doomy, as we sort of expect it would. I mean, what can you do? It was difficult subjects that we're talking about. But Lee, do you have a little tidbit, something to give us of optimism as we head into the next week?
It's midday, Friday. The FTSE 100 is up 7.2%.
Oh, well, that's good.
Who knows where it's going to finish at the end of the day?
Well, the Oracle sat there to my left. So, Simon, you called it last week. Where are we now?
Oh, I don't know what's going
to
happen.
Don't do this to me. I'm making a quote to people in the pub tonight.
I think there's a strong chance that it will end today up. What it does on Monday is beyond me. I really do not know. If you want a small note of optimism from me, okay, I'm not going to try and be some armchair epidemiologist, if I'm even using the right word there, as everybody now seems to be.
I know, right?
But I think one important thing to remember from this, when you're reading the news reports and you're seeing things like 20%, 30%, 50% of people are going to get this, and worrying about, everybody's looking at everyone thinking, I'm going to get it off everyone, is that my understanding from my limited medical knowledge is that not everyone will get it at the same time. Mm. So when you see stuff about 50% of people getting it, don't worry as much as you might be, because they're not going to all have it at exactly the same time. And we can draw on, it's not the same as the flu, it's not the same as a cold, it's not the same as all those other things, but not everybody that you see has a cold or the flu at exactly the same time and is therefore a constant risk of giving it to you.
Yeah, but you cough on the tube and look at how many people walk out of the way of you and give you some filthy stares.
Hey, look, on the bright side, you might have a seat. at the moment.
There you go. Look, notes of optimism. Brilliant. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do have any comments or questions or any notes of optimism for us, we'd love to hear them. One thing you'd like us to look into, Simon?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us @thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in the comments and find all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.